newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on newsroom decision-making, with some observations on what's going on in the news media these days with some local journalists. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union in Albany, with a couple of my colleagues here in Studio D. Judy Patrick is here, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, formerly editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. Y'all doing okay this holiday weekend, huh?
I'm good, and that answer was not created by generative AI.
Hey, it is a big holiday weekend, so we can all expect some big major news to drop, because that's what people who have bad news do. They drop it probably Friday night,
yeah,
or sometime when no one else is paying attention. We know this is what happened on holiday weekends.
Yeah, so if you are hearing this and there hasn't been big news yet, folks, it is yet to come. All right, so you want to talk about AI? Is that on your mind, Barbara? Is that why you brought this up?
I think we should all talk about that.
We should, because we've talked about it in this program before. And here's actually a little bit of news about this, which is interesting. News outlets in New York could soon be required to disclose when generative AI is used to create their content. So the state legislature overwhelmingly approved this bill that would require a proactive disclosure for stories that are substantively shaped by AI. So this is controversial because, of course, we are a nation where free speech matters, where government regulation of speech is considered anathema. But on the other hand, unfettered use of AI is likewise problematic. So here's an interesting point of view. The guy who runs Writers Guild of America East, a guy named Sam Wheeler, told the Capitol Press Room, which I believe you're familiar with, Barbara Lombardo.
Yes, I am very familiar with that.
This is a program run by David Lombardo. You may recognize the name there.
Some relation.
Yes.
You can hear him on WAMC roughly from 12:30 to 1.
Yes, how about that? So this Sam Wheeler of the Writers Guild says the measure is supposed to promote public awareness and encourage the use of human journalists.
We think that this is a common sense disclosure provision that, of course, is going to protect journalists, but we also think that it protects the public. When we talk to our journalist members who overwhelmingly supported this legislation, the most common thing that we heard throughout those discussions was that they felt like they needed to do this to protect their readers, their viewers, and their listeners.
That is a point of view, but there is stiff opposition from the organizations representing print and broadcast journalists. Why would that be? Judy used to be a part of one of those organizations. You were the vice president of the New York Press Association.
Don't tell us what to do. That's the thing. I think the government should not be telling reporters, editors, newspapers, media outlets of any kind what to do and how to do it. It's a very slippery slope. Hey, and when we're talking about how AI could be used, people are using AI to generate potential story topics. Is that substantial? Certainly it is. And so my concern, as much as I worry about the public being misled by sloppy AI-generated content, I think that you're probably, to comply with the law, you're going to have to slap one of those disclosure labels on every single thing, and to the point where it will become meaningless.
It would be meaningless. I think that the public should be able to discern whether a news outlet is using AI or not, but and to what extent. But how to do that is the rub. And stories that are substantially shaped by AI, the definition is vague, the meaning is vague. How to determine that that's really impossible to define. This is a fool's errand. And the fact that the legislature overwhelmingly approved it, this is one where it's going to be up to Hochul to do the right thing, I think, and veto this and not sign it. And
There could be, of course, this is what happens all the time with the New York State Legislature. When they pass a bill quickly, as I think is the case with this one, this came up toward the end of session, then she might sign it, say, subject to a chapter amendment, as in, we'll fix this later.
Don't we feel differently about political advertising and other forms of, when there's totally fake things being deep fakes and people saying things they didn't say online? Don't we want the public to be warned about that?
Now, does this apply to all content? Does this apply only to what is supposedly journalistic content? I think it's going to be impossible to tell in most cases whether there is, in fact, violations of this statute. If this law were to become to go into effect, I think it would be almost impossible to enforce.
How do you police it?
I agree that disclosure is important. We like the fact that we are transparent about how we do our jobs and what's entailed and how we work sources and how we come to the stories we do. But that's got to be voluntary. I don't know why I bristle at the notion of the government forcing us to do it. I just think reputable news organizations will do this kind of disclosure in a meaningful way. They will say the story for this idea came from AI or this video. I hope they never use any AI video.
So it's okay for the White House, but not for the journalists, right?
Well, everything's okay for the White House.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a really great issue for debate.
We've talked about news outlets that are letting AI write stories for them. And I think that we've talked about in the past that it's a good idea for readers to know that this story was generated by AI instead of having a byline of somebody that didn't really exist. But I think you're right, Judy, about this being a voluntary step.
I think in journalism, in that regard, it is sometimes a defensible notion to use AI because in the realm of the availability of resources to cover stories, you need to put the resources where they can do the most good. You need reporters to do serious reporting, to do the important stuff. And if you can have a AI write a little sports story, for example, if you have the facts that are entered in about the line score on a ball game and let AI write a summary, that's fine, I think, because you don't have enough reporters to cover all the games you need to cover anyway.
AI can also go through, on the other end of the spectrum, tons of data.
Yes.
And be able to winnow through the information that would take a reporter days or weeks to do.
Hey, can I make this argument? So we worry that kids nowadays aren't being able to add or subtract or multiply or divide because they just go to their calculators. What about the fact that a new reporter, an inexperienced reporter, is just using AI to generate the police, the cop story, or the basic city council story? Does that mean that they're never going to develop skills to do the more substantial reporting? I'm just worried that there's a level that young reporters go through and that generates an expertise that maybe AI will make them not learn. So there's that. I worry in colleges they're not doing that. I worry about that in general about writing. People aren't going to learn how to write because they're just going to plop some ideas into generative AI and come up with a paragraph or two.
Absolutely. And listeners, this is an opportunity for you to give us your thoughts. media@wamc.org. is how you can get your thoughts here, and we would really appreciate hearing from you. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Speaking of listeners, Larry in Massachusetts writes to us with respect to a conversation we had about Savannah Guthrie and the holding of the information about the second letter from the alleged kidnappers who had said, unbeknownst to the general public, that Savannah's mom was in fact dead. And Larry, our listener, writes, the public may well see this as a case of news people protecting their own. An unconnected woman would not be treated with this deference. Is that right? Do you think that this letter was withheld by the news organizations that knew about it because Savannah Guthrie is a famous journalist?
It couldn't hurt to assume that was a factor.
It got the coverage it did because she is such a famous person and so well-liked in general. But the downside of that is this whole thing could have been precipitated by the fact that she was a famous person. So but again, the continued presence. And I thought that they treated the story with kid gloves from the beginning.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court, folks, because there has been a lot of activity as the Supreme Court closed its term. There were a couple of cases that the Supreme Court got engaged in that had to do with journalism, which we'll get to in just a moment. But we are on a public radio station, and so we probably need to deal here on this program, The Media Project, with the key media issue, which is terrible error made by NPR's veteran Supreme Court reporter Nina Totenberg, as fine as any reporter covering the Supreme Court, certainly, who caused NPR to report that Samuel Alito was retiring. The article was, in fact, inaccurate. What lessons do we take from this?
Oh boy, never to get too big for your britches, and don't assume that you can't take for granted that even the most seasoned, respected person knows what they're doing without having double check it. And as an editor, she should have known better from the start, and her editor should have said, has it been confirmed? Did you try to get a comment from him? Did you, something that would have prevented that mistake.
The more I learn about this episode, the more worried I am about what transpired, because it's not like she mistakenly heard there was a retirement, or she heard that word and right away assumed it was Alito. What if it was Thomas? What if it was someone else? There were so many assumptions she made, and she gave the excuse that it was a rookie mistake. And as I've said before, rookies won't make this kind of mistake, because you don't leap to that kind of conclusion without checking and double checking. Putting something out there in the media environment of that significant without double checking. And the fact that NPR says they had a backstop that didn't really take effect because the backstop only double checks anonymous sources, that they trusted her, so wrong on so many levels. And the bottom line here, it affects the credibility of NPR and in the media in general.
And Nina Totenberg, who's had a distinguished career, 40 years covering the Supreme Court, certainly terrific. And here, the worst mistake of her career, here toward the end of her career, obviously. I think, too, the other thing that this exposes, which you were alluding to, it seems to me, is the closeness of a reporter to her sources. It does seem as though what we had here was a reporter who had inside information that Sam Alito does, in fact, intend to retire before the chance comes for Democrats to potentially take the Senate and interfere with the president's nomination of whomever he wants. And so she jumped, I think, on a story that she had written because she thought, oh, this is the moment we've all been waiting for.
That's the drive to be first,
yes,
rather than to be right and first. And boy, when you're at the top of your game and you are prey to that, then it's
tough.
It's a lesson for every level of reporter.
Absolutely.
And editor.
Absolutely. A lesson for all of us to check.
So do you think she should have been penalized for that?
What would you do? I don't know.
I felt like she was losing her fastball, the fact that she allowed that to happen.
The Supreme Court is a really hard beat to cover, I think, because it's so secretive. You don't really know what's going on in the background. So over the years, she has cultivated real friendships with some of the justices. And I have always maintained those friendships have gone too far. She's too close to what she covers. And the Supreme Court needs to be far more transparent about what they do, how they do it. The secrecy is honored by the reporting crew that covers them. It's partly bad system in terms of news gathering from the get-go.
Yeah, it is. The Supreme Court is a bit like The Wizard of Oz. We don't really know what's going on behind the curtain. And the curtain is drawn. If we could know what those deliberations are like, it might actually discourage our confidence in the Supreme Court, what is left of it these days, given the number of times that the court seems to have swayed its decision-making based upon the preconceived notions of the justices, which is one of those issues that we might bring up here. Here are two cases where the Supreme Court took journalists' side, actually, in this session. In two cases, they were just decided, protecting a reporter from having to divulge a source and affirming the dominant case on libel, New York Times v. Sullivan. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court basically did what a journalist would want them to do, right? And I think that is something that people who believe that the justices have preconceived notions of all the cases that they're going to take, of how they're going to rule, would be surprised by this, that the Supreme Court really protected journalists' rights in a couple of cases in this, which probably wouldn't have pleased the president who gave us that Supreme Court majority.
As far as Times versus Sullivan, I'm still worried about what is ahead for that and whether the Congress is going to change laws to make it the malice part of that statute stand. And the fact that they didn't want to deal with it was encouraging, but only for the moment. And maybe with a different case, they would be jumping on it.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're waiting for a better case so they can make a more rational argument for at least softening New York Times versus Sullivan. I think we remain in jeopardy as an industry going forward in terms of what happens to reporters who are using anonymous sources, what happens to reporters who want access to government resources, what happens to reporters who just want to basically do their job without being threatened with lawsuits. There's a lot of legal peril out there for us. Don't rest easy yet.
Just to remind listeners, the standard is reckless disregard of the truth, that even if there is erroneous reporting that causes problems for, let's say, the person who's being written about, a journalist is protected from judgment unless there is reckless disregard for the truth or actual malice in their reporting. That's the standard that was set by the New York Times v. Sullivan. The court was asked to drop that, to revisit that issue in a case brought by actually the Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, who was upset about reporting that on CNN that he claims defamed him while he was making some comments defending Donald Trump during his impeachment. And two justices, Alito and Thomas, went along with Dershowitz and said, yeah, we should go back. We want to take another look at Times v. Sullivan. And the rest of the court did not.
But his case was weak in part because CNN did make his entire transcript available, or it was the transcript or the interview on air, I forget which. So it wasn't like he could claim that he was taken out of context.
And there's a strong reason why we have such a flexible standard, because maybe the average reader or the average listener would think, well, yeah, if you get it wrong, you should be held accountable. The fact is, the media, to properly do its job, is going to make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
Even Nina Totenberg makes mistakes.
And so in order for the press to function effectively, you've got to give them a little bit of leeway. We as an industry fess up to our mistakes, correct them as quickly as we can. And the idea of actual malice needs to be put in there. But you also need to give us a little bit of flexibility, because we are going to make mistakes. It's inevitable.
And so the protection for those errors is what's implicit in this assessment that now still stands. That's where we are. Before we leave the topic of the court, we really ought to talk about how the court's rulings are being covered by MAGA media, which seems to be viewing the decisions of the court as being betrayal of Donald Trump by the justices on the right. So, for example, when Amy Coney Barrett, one of the president's appointees, sided with the liberal justices in rejecting the Trump administration's effort to gut mail-in voting, my goodness, you would think that was the biggest thing that went on. A shockingly wrong opinion. The line, I'm trying to find the actual line that Fox News used, that MAGA world was upset about this. And this is how it is being portrayed in MAGA media. It is just another example of how differently the right-wing media views so many issues and what a skewed perspective people get if they're only watching Fox News.
Didn't the Washington Post also frame some of its reporting on whether Trump won or lost, who were the winners or losers in the cases?
as who are the winners as opposed to the actual decisions themselves.
Was it a pro-Trump or an anti-Trump?
Right.
But you're right that Fox went, as you'd be surprised to learn, over the line on that.
Yeah.
They're editorializing in their news.
Their coverage said that their headline blurred, "Conservatives revolt after Trump-appointed Barrett joins liberals in shockingly wrong ruling." That's not the way that it was depicted in mainstream media.
It's covered almost like sport. Almost like a wrestling tournament or a soccer game, I guess you could use that expression. And what it does is devalue the discussion of the issue behind it, which can be complicated, and maybe you would lose the attention of your average viewer when you really go into the nuances of the Constitution and how it affects this particular case. I tend to understand that, but I think the way that the media, a lot of even the mainstream media, tends to frame the Supreme Court in a hyperbolic way that they didn't used to, and make the Supreme Court justices, we have given them labels. They are conservative justices. They are liberal justices. And as a result, they are more in the spotlight than they ever were before. I think more. I'd love to do a poll of how many people who can name how many Supreme Court justices, because 10 years ago, nobody could name any of them. And I think people nowadays could name a few. I don't know if I could name all. I could name all nine. But yeah. Please don't test me.
Yeah.
Right now.
Here we go. Okay, no. No, we won't. But I think you're right that the public has taken an interest in this, in part because the hearings to confirm Supreme Court justices have become major political extravaganzas. It is true. To remember when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was appointed to the Supreme Court by Bill Clinton, she was counsel for the ALCU, but I think she was confirmed unanimously, and nothing like that would happen at this era. Every Supreme Court justice is grilled, and it becomes a great partisan contest. And so we all pay attention to this. And then each side in the political debate assesses court decisions based upon whether a justice is siding with them or not. We view them all as partisans.
I don't view them all as partisans 100%, but yeah, some have liberal leanings and some have conservative leanings, and that's how the system is supposed to work, because we've given the presidents the power to name the justices, so they're going to pick people who are going to be in their image.
What interests me is this notion of especially the right-wing media, giving these kinds of litmus tests for the justices. Another thing that they've been looking at lately is, since Mayor Mamdani was elected in New York, and in the primaries last week, where 9 of 10 candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America won their races in primaries in blue districts, the right-wing media has just erupted. And the language that is being used is about the threat of a communist takeover of America, which is just an astonishing thing. Those of us who aren't great followers of Fox News perhaps may not be aware of this, but this is over and over again the way that the news is being couched about the primaries on Fox News.
Excuse me, pardon me, folks. This is your producer, David Gustina. I just want to say communism is not socialism, and why doesn't the media spend a little more time explaining that?
Well,
they let it
like
go. They just let it go. The communists are coming over. That's not communism. And socialism, in the way that they're describing it, wanting health benefits and education and other things, is not the same thing.
I think it's a good point, David. In a country with 33 million small businesses, home ownership, 2/3 of the homes in America are actually owned, where 156 million Americans own publicly traded stocks. I don't think there's going to be communism here. I'm grateful for this to Decoding Fox News, a website that I follow for a lot of my understanding of what's going on in Fox. I get a lot of transcripts from them. And so that means we are not really, 70% of the U.S. economy, by the way, is based on consumer spending. This is not a country where we're going to have communism. That's different from socialism.
How to repeat that and how to tell that in stories. And to a lot of people, socialism, communism, they're undistinguishable, and they don't really care to know the difference. They just know that they've been told that this is bad.
Oh, yeah. It is astonishing, and it's seeping through. Even before these primaries, you would get this idea of trying to brand, especially progressive Democrats, as socialists. And that being a bad thing, I think one of the things Mamdani has done is try to embrace the term and try to make people understand what it actually means. But I agree, the media's got to do a better job of explaining what this is and that it's not communism. You're right. I hear it from the right wing. I hear it from right wing media way, way too much. And it's we all know it's going to build on itself.
Part of what the mainstream media could do, but they don't do enough, is every time it's brought up, there has to be a part of a sentence or a sentence saying what the reality is, but that becomes a tiresome and tedious task, and you feel like you're repeating yourself over and over, so you tend to not do that. If our readers, when you're reading or listening to that use of communism, what else is the broadcaster or the writer telling you to make that clear in your mind?
And guys, even the even Democratic centrists, the Democrats were more centrist in their views, they seem to be scared by going to that democratic socialism because of the way it's labeled communism. So they won't embrace it. And you can see how that's played out in election after election in this country.
I would like to know that, I'd like you all to know that Schenectady proudly elected a socialist mayor about 100 years ago. And you could read stories about what he did for the city of Schenectady at the time in terms of public education, public supermarkets. It's a really interesting story, and it just illustrates what socialism could do in this country at that level.
In my home state of South Dakota, by the way, not known as a socialist stronghold, when they couldn't get enough cement for the highways that they needed to build
cement
for the growing state. Sorry, yeah, cement, yes. We had a state cement plant, and the state actually produced cement because, how is it supposed to be said? Is that right?
I don't know.
Cement.
Cement.
For God's sake.
State cement.
The cement pump.
Come on, guys. The post office is a socialist institution.
Absolutely. Hi. All right. So we'll get back to this, folks.
So come on, media. Let's report this correctly.
Yeah. Very well. All right. That's all we have time for today. The Media Project. This week, you've had Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, and our producer, David Gustina. We thank you for joining us. We hope you come back again next week for The Media Project.
It's the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the bill.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.